Let's start with Lloyd Austin. Yesterday, he said the coming weeks and months will be crucial for Ukraine. In your opinion, what they're doing, what's their strategy in Ukraine?
I'd give you several answers to that. First, let's take Secretary of Defense Austin. And he's exemplifying the very stark reason I say we should never put a serving military officer who's only been out for a short time, should be at least 10 years if you're ever going to do it, in this position, because he is lip-syncing the president, the secretary of state, and the national security advisor. He's doing lick-spittle everything that they tell him to do. He doesn't deviate an iota from their line. Their line is purely politics. It's purely political because of Biden's fear of the election growing every day as polling begins to demonstrate that Trump not only has a chance, he may even be ahead in some very key places. Second, there is this reluctance on the part of the military. And the testimony recently by the last American general in Kabul to the Congress, while it had some political overtones that were disturbing, it sort of went at the Biden administration and not at the Republicans, even though Trump had set up the deal that Biden was handcuffed by when he pulled out of Afghanistan. And ultimately, I think that was the best decision. Just get out because you're not doing any good for anybody. And then thirdly, I think that reflects what is happening with the military in addition to the politicos, and it augments the politicos without their even having to ask for it. And that is, they are ashamed of themselves for being so grossly mistaken about Ukraine's capacity, and more importantly, about Russia's incapacity in this present conflict. They've been proven dead wrong once again. Let's just count them up since 9/11, how many dead wrong situations the U.S. military forces and particularly their leadership have been involved in. So this is very embarrassing. So they're putting all this pablum out, all these lies out. I listened to Putin. I listened to Putin the other day, and I marveled at the clear-headedness of the straightforwardness. He was doing a press conference. Oh, yeah, they're scripted to a certain extent, but you could tell from his facial expression, he got a couple of difficult follow-ups. He handled it so smoothly. And what he was in essence saying was, I don't get it. When are these people going to wake up? When are they going to wake up and realize that I do not want all of Ukraine, wouldn't want it if it was handed to me on a plate, too hard to govern. Two, I've pretty much proven that I'm the victor here. Three, I can't even get them to talk about a set of negotiations to which I'm invited. Imagine that. And I'm sure he's being straightforward about that, too, because I'm hearing the same thing from our White House, that, you know, we'll have negotiations somewhere, but we won't invite the Russians. Are you kidding me? That's half the situation. So this is another example of our inability to handle this situation, which has gone so sour for us that we don't know how to extricate ourselves from it, and we don't know how to extricate Zelensky from it. Now, from what I'm hearing from Polish and Hungarian and other contacts, Zelensky is looking at ways to perhaps extricate himself. Now, I don't know whether he's coordinating any of that with Washington. I doubt it very seriously. If he is, he's probably saying things like, I need to get out because I know I can't do much anymore. Because look at the population differences. I just looked at that today. They started out with about 35, 40 million people. They're probably down now. A demographer is over there right now doing this sort of head count thing, difficult to do. But they probably are down to about 20 million people now. Think about that for a minute. A country that started out with about 40 million, and through refugees and deaths and wounds and such, all of which is being obfuscated and hidden by us too, our media especially, the casualties are much larger than they've been reporting, is down to 20 million. That's 50% of your population. This is preposterous. And all we're doing is prolonging Ukraine's agony and giving Putin a chance to do some things that might make their agony long-term seriously. like take Odessa, like push the entire Black Sea coast out of Ukraine's hands. It's preposterous what we're doing. I begin to think, you know, I've said before, I think we have some insane people in charge. I'm beginning to think I might be right. Yeah. It's not just adjectives.
Larry, the other day we had Victoria Nuland on ABC News talk demanding the U.S. open the facilitating the strikes by Kiev on the military bases inside Russia. Does she have any sort of influence on the Biden administration or anybody in this administration to facilitate these kind of thinking?
I don't think she does anymore, and I think that's part of her frustration and why she makes such blatantly stupid statements. However, there are neoconservatives filtered throughout the government still, and very influential ones in the Congress and on the outside that have influence on the inside. So when you see something like that, you know that she's probably been put out there by the neoconservative leadership to put a marker down. And it's in the middle of a political fray that Trump exacerbates, that the Republicans in general exacerbate, Republicans like Lindsey Graham, for example, who has given me I'm from South Carolina. I know what Lindsey Graham has to do to get elected. I know what he has to do to stay elected, which is a South Carolina forte, staying in there forever. Strom Thurmond, Mendel Rivers, you name the politician. South Carolina likes to send him there and keep him there forever. But still, Lindsey has proved himself to be an absolute Newt Gingrich-like idiot. He backed up a lot. He took some of the things he said, like the Nagasaki Hiroshima remarks, he sort of mellowed them out a little bit because he realized he really sounded like a fool. But still, that's the people we've got. And so they still have influence on the Biden administration, particularly through the political levers. If Biden thinks this is going wrong because of his lack of outspokenness about Ukraine, he's going to go out and speak about Ukraine. Same with Gaza. Same with anything else that he feels is threatening him. We have a situation now where we are looking at a November. I had an old farmer say this to me last week. We are looking at a November where we go to the ballot box, if we care to go, to vote for a man who's so old he may collapse before he even gets through the president-elect process, if you will, and a person who on January the 6th previously tried to overthrow the government and keep himself in power. Had it not been for a few brave people, including his vice president, Mike Pence, he might have succeeded. That's our choice. That's how low we've sunk.
We know that Zelensky's term has finished. He's continuing in his position under the martial law. And Poroshenko is not happy with the situation right now in Ukraine. We have a lot of political movements inside Ukraine who are not happy with the situation. At the same time, you see Europeans and the United States are totally supporting Zelensky.
No, not anymore.
No.
Not anymore. No, they're falling apart. Just as I said they would, but I didn't think they'd do it quite this fast. Germany, France, some of the tent poles of NATO are having such bitter arguments inside right now, including amongst the military leadership in Brussels. And the arguments are indicative of just how bad they have made the situation, and they know it for them politically in their own countries, but also how desperate they've made the situation with regard to the entire integrity of NATO. So this is happening much faster than I thought it was going to happen, but it is happening. The arguments are quite internecine now. They're quite bitter. And you throw people like, well, let's put it this way, the new Charles de Gaulle, Macron, into it. And you throw people like a guy who, if the Germans, his poll ratings are so low, if the Germans held an election tomorrow, he couldn't make dog catcher. You throw all that in there and you throw in their recognition of why they're in that situation and why they can't get out of it and what it means to try to get out of it, and that Ukraine is an integral part of that. And you have a real dissension developing in the ranks of NATO right now. It isn't being reported, but it's there. They don't want to report it, of course. And the media is lickspittle too. The media in all the West is just bought and paid for by the political leaderships.
Yeah, we had an offensive in Kharkiv. Putin said about this offensive in Kharkiv in the northern part of Ukraine. He said, we are trying to make a buffer zone because they're attacking the civilian areas in Belgorod. At the same time, we're hearing a member of Bundestag was talking about Poland and Romania shooting anything, using air defense system of NATO and shooting everything comes to the western part of Ukraine. Larry, what would be the red line at this particular moment for this conflict? Because it can get nuclear. We know that the Russians were talking about non-strategic nuclear weapons. We know how fragile is the situation right now in Ukraine. How do you see, what would be the red line for these activities that we're seeing on both parts?
I think Putin's one, if you want to call it, strategic error has been his time to time hinting at nuclear weapons. I was very much more content with the way he handled the press conference I was watching a day or two ago, where he really fielded some somewhat difficult questions. And I think the gist of what he was saying was, I've done what I've got to do. I don't really, he didn't say this, but it was sort of latent there. I don't really want to do a whole lot more, but if Ukraine forces me to do a whole lot more, I will. And read also in parentheses, my military thinks that I ought to do more, and they're ready to do more. And I put a guy in charge of my economy, hooking it up to the military industrial complex, if you will, who's smart and going to do it for the long term. This is something we're not paying any attention to, or if we are, we're not talking about it. And that is that Putin is, with this appointment of this economist to be his minister of defense, he's hooking, as we did in 1941 and two, his incredible industrial capacity, which is still a lot latent, but there, surviving from the old Soviet Union. He's hooking it up to his military instrument, directly hooking it up. And that way, you give orders to the economy, they've gone from something like 6% of GDP to about 7 or 8% of GDP. That's going out to the military. That's a lot of money. They've got a lot of money, and China's helping. It's going out to the military now through a very directed way, and in a way that's going to prepare Putin for bigger war. But he's not preparing for a bigger war with Ukraine. He's preparing for war with NATO, should it come about. I wish he'd keep the nuclear component out of it, but, you know, he's got nuclear weapons. He's free to do that if he wants to. I think it's stupid to do that. If it takes that, maybe he thinks it does, to scare the bejesus out of old Joe Biden, then maybe he's got a point. But I'm really worried about what's happening with this axis that's developing between Moscow, Beijing, to a certain extent Tehran and Pyongyang, because they all have an incredible capacity to hook what could be fairly powerful elements of their economy to a military regime, much the way Hitler did in 37, 38, and 39. While everybody else was sleeping, here he is building tanks and building cannons and ammunition and everything else. It shows me what Putin expects the future to be like. And I don't think he's a stupid man. I think he's a very smart man. I think he's a very strategic thinker. So he's getting ready. He's getting ready for bigger war, not necessarily nuclear, but he's getting ready to take us on if he needs to, take NATO on if he needs to. And while I do think that if NATO were to make a significant penetration into the SCTO regime, the Security Collective Treaty Organization, they might use a nuclear weapon on the head of the NATO penetration. But let me clue every one of the people listening to this show in, there is no way on God's green earth that NATO could make a penetration in the end of the SCTO that would last for more than a day and go more than 100 kilometers. It's absurd. I can give you the stats. I just testified. I can give you the stats on how sorry the United States military is in terms of mobilization capability and readiness right now. It's as bad as it's been since the early 1970s, post-Vietnam. That's how bad it is. So anyone talking in the military leadership or in the civilian leadership or to the civilian leadership about America's readiness to mobilize and take on a country that's been at war for 2+ years and is now hooked up decisively its economy, which is banging away, to its military is just pure insanity. And Europe's no better. Germany's no better. France is no better. Italy's no better. Norway's no better. Finland's no better. Sweden's no better. You're looking at a comedy of errors featuring fool after fool after fool.
I don't know how they can communicate the military with the political elites in the United States. Is there any crucial communication between these two? Because Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken, these guys who are making decisions, they have to know the reality of the military, of the army of the United States right now. Is there any sort of communication to understand what's really going on?
It's difficult to say. I don't think any of the military leadership, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who may be ignorant himself. He may be ignorant himself. I don't mean that in a derisive way. I mean, he just does not know the bad state of his armed forces. I don't think there's anyone, though, that does know, and there's got to be some who do, some of the colonels in particular, has the courage, moral or physical, even, to go forward and give the real status of the U.S. Armed Forces. I think I told you earlier, I testified before the Personnel Subcommittee of the Senate Armed Services Committee a little while ago. That was on the revolving door, but then we went over, two major generals and myself went over to speak to one of the members of the Senate Armed Services Committee, the parent committee. And when we talked to her about the need for conscription, the need for a draft, we talked in terms of 1940. We talked about the Selective Service and Training Act of 1940 that essentially put a group of people finally under the draft, conscripted them, all men at that time, brought them in, and then Roosevelt in the summer of 41 had to go back because they were only initially drafted for 12 months of service. That's all Congress would approve. He had to go back to the Congress and say, I want to extend that draft from 12 months to 36, and we really ought to do it, he hinted, for the duration of what is coming. That passed by one vote in the U.S. Congress. Pearl Harbor was 5 months later. It passed by one vote. Well, we're in a similar situation today, only I would argue we're in far worse shape because at that time, Roosevelt was sitting on, and the Great Depression had made vibrant, I know that sounds odd, a latent industrial capacity that was just incredible. Once it was unleashed, it produced 50% of the world's gross domestic product. We're not sitting on that today. China's sitting on that today. To a certain extent, Russia's sitting on that today. To a certain extent, India's sitting on that today. We are not sitting on anything like that today. In fact, we're sitting on $35 trillion of aggregate debt, a $1 trillion payment this year on that debt, which equals our defense budget. No idea how we're going to get out of that. And we're sitting on an industrial base that is about as latent as my sandbox.
This new visit of Putin to China was so different. And when you look at this visit and you see Xi embracing Putin, not Putin embracing Xi, that was so important, I think.
And agreeing to do a pipeline series across the rivers there and to actually exclude all U.S. currency or U.S. banking or SWIFT or anything else. They're going to pay for it in renminbi and rubles. It's going to go back and forth. It's going to be billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars. And it's going to be all outside the U.S. system, outside the rules-based order, outside the Bretton Woods system. And we're just sitting here. It's happening in plain sight. And we're just sitting here on our thumbs.
At the same time, you see nothing is coming out of Washington instead of sanctioning China, sanctioning Russia. And what's in it after decades of sanctioning. What was the outcome of this attitude, in your opinion, Leon?
You want the pièce de résistance? Recently, I got a cable from the Cuban ambassador here in Washington. You probably saw this, we just graciously took Cuba off the list of states that are obstreperous with regard to terrorism, states that don't cooperate fully. We didn't take them off the really draconian one, state sponsors of terror. Cuba hadn't sponsored terror in 30 years, if they did it ever. That was a gracious act by Tony Blinken, you know, it was a gracious act by Joe Biden. That's poppycock. Why do we have an embargo on a country of 11 million people whose president recently said, what do you want, Mr. Biden? You want a new Haiti in the Caribbean? Because that's what you're doing. You're making us turn into a new Haiti. This is how stupid we are. I mean, this is just a small case, 11 million people on an island 90 miles off the coast of Florida, but it's an indicative case of just how wrong-headed we are. Wooden-headed we are, insane we are. And that's, why is Biden doing that? Biden promised, and I was involved in this. I helped President Obama get to the point where we were at a meaningful rapprochement with Havana. I saw this, I was in Havana when Raul Castro made his speech and when Barack Obama made his speech. There wasn't a dry eye in the theater. Everyone was crying after 50 years of embargo. Stupid policy. Well, guess what? Biden said, as vice president, I'll carry on. I'll do the same thing that President Obama was doing. Well, he didn't. He's been draconian. He's been draconian as Donald Trump was with regard to Cuba. Why? Because the Democrats want to win that seat in Florida that Rick Scott occupies. And Rick Scott is such a dumb son of a, you know, whatever, that he may lose. And so, oh, no improvement with U.S.-Cuba relations. Well, just magnify that across the globe. That's U.S. foreign policy. That's U.S. security policy. It's that stupid.
How connected right now are Russia and China, and how this partnership is getting deeper, in your opinion?
Well, I don't want to make too much of it because I know and was a product of, if you will, those years, some of them anyway, where China and Russia were at loggerheads most of the time. And you expect countries like that, that have such different systems, and Khrushchev was right when he said they had different systems, and you have a common border as long as they do. For years now, Chinese have been crossing that common border and doing trade in Russia, and Putin and other Russian leaders have been able to do nothing about it. And China takes most of the commerce away from that, most of the profits away from that. So to see them cheek and jowl now, as Mao Zedong said, I believe it was, or maybe it was Kim Jong-un or Kim Jong-il, close his lips and teeth, to see them that way is quite a remarkable thing for an old China hand like me. But I think it's real because of the United States. I think it's real because we have put them in a position where they have no other choice. If they either bow to the empire, and China in particular, it does not like bowing to the empire, particularly in the really obtrusive ways that we sometimes demand it. We treat China's South China Sea as if it were another our Gulf of Mexico. It's absurd the way we treat it. We are the biggest hypocrites in the world too, especially with things like that. So I think it is significant, and I'm just waiting to see how much probably the smartest led state in the world today, and it ain't China, and it ain't Russia, it's India. And I'm not necessarily saying Modi is the smartest leader in the world. What I'm saying is that India has some impressive leadership. And if they weren't doing what they're doing to their Muslim population, they would be skyrocketing, in my mind, into world leadership as fast as you can put them there. So I'm waiting to see what happens with India. India's not happy with us either. They're a tacit ally. They got a lot of nuclear technology from us. Their Navy loves exercising with us because we still are, you know, supposed to be the king of the sea. But that's not really enduring connections. What's enduring is who is the best at leading the world and the major nations in the world, economically, financially, diplomatically, not militarily. You know, I was looking at a quotation from, it was a former defense minister, former head of the IDF in Israel, and he was remarking with regard to the situation in Gaza now, Shaul Mofaz. He essentially said, if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. But what he actually said, his remarks were, if you base your strategy on force alone, then you must kill people routinely. That's exactly right. What have we based our strategy on since 9/11? Force and sanctions, sanctions and force. And we've been killing people either directly, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, or through proxies, Ukraine, Gaza. That is not what the world appreciates. The world despises that. I don't care what kind of governments they have. They despise that. They can't live with that. So they will move and gather and balance us, and we will be at an end.
Before Putin going to China, we had new tariffs on China from 25% to 100%. Biden, it's amazing. He's giving a gift to Putin before going to China.
Absolutely. And I like what Orban said. I think it was Orban when Xi made a promise to create electric car factories in Hungary. We said we would put the same kind of tariffs on those automobiles if they were made in Chinese factories in Hungary. And Orban, I think it was Orban who said, well, you just make the American consumer pay more for a better car. Because that's all tariffs do. And they cause inflation big time.
It's not going to be in the benefit of the people in the United States, ordinary people in the United States. I talked with Michael Hodson. He said that these new tariffs would make everything more difficult for Americans. All the benefit of these tariffs would go to the pocket of 1% at the top, the United States.
Mike Lofgren, who is an old hand in the Congress, worked in the Congress for, I think, something like 30 years, wrote an article today that he sent me a copy of. And it just captures spot on what's happening in this country and why the Trump phenomena has been basically misdiagnosed. The problem is the huge gap in wealth, which is unprecedented in American history. And so you've got people on both ends of that who are trying to perpetuate it, as you just suggested, and at the other end, figure out what to do about it. And so Trump kind of got into the middle of that, smelled it, and started exploiting it. But it's not a problem of dummies versus smarties, college graduates versus, you know, blue-collar workers. It's everyone understands inchoately, if not directly, that we have murdered ourselves and we're paying the 0.001% godzillion trillions of dollars in order to keep the murder going. It's absurd.
Yeah, Larry, it's so amazing. And they're so bragging about capitalism, the way that the United States is implementing capitalism. At the same time, you see their military industrial complex just losing in Ukraine to Russia, which is a fraction of their budget.
Well, it includes, you know, yours truly. 10 years ago, Powell and I were talking about Russia, and he said, gas station, Moscow is a gas station with pumps. And you know, I kind of agreed with him. We were wrong. There's far more to the Russian economy than just oil and gas, though that dominates it. And that's at this particular point in time, not so much probably, I hope, in 30 years, that's a pretty good dominant economic matter, oil and gas out the yin yang. But there are other things too. And now the foundries and the things that make things And Xi has probably promised him all manner of technological improvement and technological advice and technological, everything from semiconductors to whatever you want. That's one reason I don't think we're going to have a war between Taiwan and China, too, because the two together are pretty much dominating some of these very critical sectors. But it's another indicator of people who are working in a cooperative, collaborative way while maintaining what they can of their own superiority in various fields of that competition, but not threatening each other with war and death and destruction or sanctions in the process. And it doesn't matter that they're not democracies. It doesn't matter at all. They're doing what they need to do to survive in a very different world than the one that existed 30 years ago. And they're doing a pretty good job of it, whether it's making electric cars and regenerative agriculture or other things that are happening. They're doing a pretty good job of it, but they're collaborating and coordinating. They're not forcing anybody to do things. And that's a far better model for the future than the one we're offering, which is coercive. And what was it Shaul Mofaz said? When your strategy is nothing but force and sanctions, you have to kill people routinely. How many kids did we kill in Iraq with our sanctions? That Madeleine Albright, when she was identified with the fact that we might have killed 500,000, I think it was. And she said, well, that's the price of defeating a tyrant.
How do you see the situation right now in Georgia? I think it's getting more in the same line that Ukraine went in the aftermath of 2014. We are witnessing some sort of color revolution. We have this law of foreign agent passed by the parliament, then vetoed by the president. At the same time, we see the foreign ministers of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, and they're marching. They're protesting in Georgia against this discussion that is going on in Georgia. When you look at the situation right now in Georgia, how dangerous is this situation? How fragile is the situation right now?
Well, the first thing I would say, and I haven't been paying a great deal of attention to Tbilisi. I'm supposed to go there next month for a conference with, of all people, the Iranians. But I would suspect that's our CIA. I would suspect that we are like that with the Ministry of Defense and others in Georgia, and have been ever since George W. Bush in 2003 or four. Went to Tbilisi and said, you'll be a member of NATO, blah, blah, blah. And then the Russians more or less took the two northwest oblasts. And they're still there, as far as I know, some Russian troops. So I would suspect that that's coordinated by the CIA. And what we're trying to do is deflect Putin's attention from Ukraine by starting messes in other places. And Georgia would be the place I would pick to do that, because that's where we have so many long-time connections. I don't think it'll bother Putin that much, because he could dispatch one division and march straight on Tbilisi and probably take care of that very, very quickly, very, very swiftly. He wouldn't want to, and he wouldn't want to divert forces that way. But if we're going to do that around his periphery, if we're going to stoke rebellions, color revolutions or whatever around his periphery, then he's going to have to deal with that. That might explain to a certain extent why he makes these innuendo-like remarks with regard to nuclear weapons, because at some point he's going to get tired of this. At some point he's going to get tired of it. But I'd almost be willing to bet you considerable money that that's the CIA. And all you have to do is go, Lithuania, Riga, come on, let's go. Let's go to Georgia.
In Switzerland, they're having a summit on Ukraine, and they have invited Lula and South Africa. Lula said, then we're not going to be there. There is no reason to be there because Russia is not there. And the head of South Africa said the same thing. We don't know, we still don't know if China would attend this summit.
Good
But
for good for Lula and good for South Africa. I mean, it's preposterous. Putin alluded to this in his conversation with the journalist. Why would we want to go if, why would anybody want to go if we're going to talk about Ukraine and one of the antagonists is not there? It's a standard Washington technique to appear to be doing something when you have no idea what to do. I suspect that's what this is all about. Now, if they were to change their minds tomorrow morning and invite Russia, I'd change my mind, but not until they do.
We've seen that International Criminal Court, they're talking about arrest warrant and Netanyahu. And at the same time, Anthony Blinken's secretary is saying that this decision was shameful. And
oh, issue that for the Russians in Ukraine and it'll be glorious. But issue it for real criminals in Israel and it's a shame. That's that. Our hypocrisy knows no bounds. It is utterly incredible what hypocrites we are. And the court did it, you know, I have to brush up on this because it's been a long time since I dealt with him. I was Powell's sort of info man on the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court. The ICJ, of course, is a descendant of the permanent International Court of Justice, which started with the League of Nations. And then when the UN was formed in San Francisco and we did all the deliberations for that, people decided, including, I'm told, Eisenhower was all for this, we needed to continue. And so we just dropped the P in the International Court of Justice, and that deals with states. The ICC is the Rome Statute. Back up for a minute. All the states in the UN are subject to the ICJ, the International Criminal Court, or International Court of Justice. Its Court of Arbitration, for example, went and decided if China had the right to do what it did with regard to the Philippines, and said no, and the Philippines had the right to do what it wanted to do, and China totally ignored it. So that's the power of that court. As Mao said, international law comes out of the barrel of a gun. Now, the International Criminal Court's a different deal. It's the Rome Statute, and we were amongst stellar countries like Libya at the time, like Israel, the only ones, about six countries, as I recall, that didn't sign up to the ICC. It deals with individuals, that is to say, war criminals. So when it indicts someone, it says, okay, we're coming in and getting you. There is a part of it, though, that says if the state in question from which this individual is picked up and brought before the tribunal, if it's capable and we judge it capable in its own justice system and seems to have intent to deal with this war criminal, potential war criminal, themselves, we'll leave it alone. We'll let their court system deal with it. But if we judge that they don't, either they don't have the system that we recognize as being fair and decent, or they don't have the intent, or both, then we're going to pluck them out and we're going to call them war criminals and we're going to try them. Well, that's what they've done. And in the case of Israel, of course, they've said, no, they don't have the intent. They might have the court system, but they don't have the intent. With the case of Hamas, they don't have either. And so they did a very balanced job. They took the three key Hamas leaders, and they took Yoav Gallant and Bibi Netanyahu from Israel. They are the people they're identifying as being in charge of this genocide in Gaza. And, of course, the three Hamas leaders were in charge of the October 7th tragedy in Israel. I thought it was a tremendously balanced decision. So that means Blinken is a fool again. I mean, I'm getting tired of calling Tony Blinken a fool and a hypocrite and a liar and a prevaricator and a lousy guitar player and a lousy singer and a lousy judge of music. God, how bad can you be as Secretary of State?
There is an article in Al Jazeera. They're saying that Israel is losing in Gaza. And right now we've seen that Israel was doing, Netanyahu was insisting that he's going to destroy Hamas. How successful they have implemented their strategy in Gaza. If you were to evaluate it, assess it, just not being on the part of Gazans or Israelis.
First, you need a strategy to assess before you can do it. Second, I would try to put together statements made by Yoav Gallant and by others like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu himself and come up with what might have been their strategic objectives. And you just reiterated two of them. I would put a third one in there, get the hostages back. Based on what Netanyahu primarily has said, destroy Hamas, get the hostages back, and make sure that Gaza no longer can be a hotbed of rebellion or whatever. Failed, failed, failed. Not only have they failed on getting rid of Hamas, Hamas is now attacking them in the north, and they're having to turn troops around and head them back to the north to try and take care of the Hamas fighters who were back in the north in the rubble, which is now a very, very good place for fighters like Hamas to fight from. They're having to take care of them, and they're losing soldiers in the process. The second objective of getting the hostages back, I don't even need to comment on. They are not gotten back. And the third objective of making sure that Gaza can't possibly be a bed of rebellion, if you will, in the future, is preposterous. As long as the Palestinians have one person left, as long as the idea of a Palestinian state is still viable, and it's viable if there's one person left thinking that idea, as long as Hamas is around, as long as any kind of force to fight the occupier is around and people are around to supply and furnish that force with whatever it needs, like Qatar and other Arab states, you're not going to do it. What was it Shaul Mofaz said? If your strategy is force, you will constantly be killing people. I woke up last night, 2 a.m., and I said to myself, how can I put this succinctly? So I wrote it on a 3x5 card. This is what I wrote. The only way Israel can survive as a state located in the eastern Mediterranean between the Jordan River and that sea, and as a state that serves as a safe haven for Jews, is if it is not a Jewish state. Let me say that again. Is if it is not a Jewish state. In short, it must be a true liberal democracy, welcoming all citizens, affording them equal rights, humanitarian and otherwise. Incidentally, I continued, that's the only meaningful way that U.S. support for Israel can survive as well. The two go hand in hand. Then I flipped the card over and I wrote, and this was hard. Today, in Gaza, the demise of both is in the wind. I can smell it. It has a putrid, decadent odor that only a fool cannot recognize. That's where we are. So little old me, who said a couple of years ago, Israel wouldn't be a state in 20 years, it's looking more and more like I was prophetic. And unless we are willing to force, however you do that, and we have a lot of leverage if we want to have it, Israel to become a liberal democratic state and welcome all citizens with equal rights and stay where they are and deal with it as they have to once they do that with U.S. support, which will be a lot easier to give if they are a liberal democratic state, we aren't going anywhere except into hell. And Israel and us are going together.